hearing. Appeal number 073095, Lott versus Levitt. Oh. Mr. Parker.
May it please the court, I'm Jeffrey Parker for the appellant, John Lott. Your Honors, the case is a civil action for libel, and it's here on appeal from a Rule 12b-6 dismissal by the district court of one of two counts of the original complaint, which dismissal was predicated on an application of the Illinois innocent construction rule, as it is known. Now, there are several reversible errors committed by the district court. Let me enumerate them and we can discuss. First, the district court misapplied Illinois substantive state law. Second, the district court failed to observe federal procedural law. Third, Illinois law wasn't applicable in any case. And fourth, the district court should have granted leave to amend.
Let me ask you about that third point. It seems that everyone was proceeding under the assumption that Illinois law applied, and you agreed to that. And it looks to me like when maybe you saw that the tide was turning against you here, you made this 11th hour claim that it was not Illinois law, but it was Virginia law that would control. Is that an inaccurate view to take of what happened?
Your Honor, I can't comment on what the motivations were. I can only point out, as shown in the record.
You're the one that did it, so you could tell me what the motivations were.
Well, there was a change of counsel following that time, so I don't know what the motivations were.
The motivation of your client.
And as you might expect, our argument was that there was no intent to waive the choice of law issue. It was always in the case. The defendants argued on that very motion. Now, the court relied very heavily on a footnote in the plaintiff's memorandum of law that, as we point out, was ambiguous on that point.
What was ambiguous about it? The footnote agree that Illinois law applies. There's nothing ambiguous.
Well, first of all, that the footnote is dropped from a federal case discussing a question of First Amendment law. That's number one. So it doesn't really make sense in its context. All we're saying is, given the fact that, as you see in many cases of this court, where this question is discussed, the court itself has pointed out there's been some loose practice on this, where courts and counsel sometimes say, well, the applicable law is the law of the forum state. And as we know, that's, strictly speaking, not the correct rule. The correct rule is the applicable law is given by the conflicts rules of the forum state. So when you concede that Illinois law applies, this was the argument raised below, by conceding that Illinois law applies, you're not conceding that Illinois substantive local law applies, even if you do concede that Illinois law applies, as it must under Claxton.
Except there were no citations to Virginia law.
Your Honor is correct.
So you're kind of stuck with this.
I'm stuck with it, and what I've asked this court to do, given that we believe there was discretion to consider this, and I don't believe, to be more directly responsive to Judge Evans' question, I don't believe there's any showing that there was any nefarious intent here, and that since it is the case that the court wants to get it right, it seems to me this court ought to decide whether or not in its discretion it would prefer to apply the correct law rather than the incorrect
Wait
law.
Wait a second. No, that gives you a windfall at your opponent's expense, and that's not the way the game is.
Well, Your Honor, let me try to, I don't mean to interrupt you, but let me try to defend that more specifically. We're operating in a regime where this court has twice held that the applicable law in a case like this, under Illinois law, is the law of the plaintiff's domicile, period. And it's very uncommon to see the term period in a choice of law decision, especially in a state like Illinois that follows interest analysis. So I do think that there is some supervisory issue here, I guess is what I'm saying, and that this matter was briefed in the court below. The defendants essentially argued that the district court should not follow this court's cases in Cook and Rice. Now, I'm sorry.
I was going to suggest that maybe you should move to your argument
yes.
that you can win this case under Illinois law.
Yeah, I think that, that Your Honor anticipates me. We don't think that this is a proper application of even just plain old substantive Illinois law. Before you get to any question of the procedural posture, for several reasons. The first is that and remember, all of this is subject to de novo review. You have to be convinced that the district court is correct. It's not a discretionary matter. First point is that the district court's construction of the challenge passage here was not even a construction, much less a reasonable one or an innocent one. The reason is that the district court took a construction of this passage that essentially said the words tried to replicate could be construed to mean tried to differ. And it seemed to me that whatever you define as replicate, it can't mean differ. Those are opposite concepts. They're not the same. So it's not even a construction. Second point, even if we take that construction, it does not address the per se defamatory aspect of this challenge passage in whole, as the district court itself held. It held that the challenge passage was defamatory per se, as imputing both lack of integrity and lack of competence to the plaintiff. The innocent construction only addresses the lack of integrity point. It does not address the lack of competence point. So the district court's opinion is internally inconsistent in that respect. Third, the district court, we don't believe, followed the recent cases, especially Tuitt, but also Bryson, which are the Illinois controlling cases here, regarding the question of what is the reasonable reader. The district court essentially assumed the reasonable reader didn't know anything, right?
No, the district court assumed that the reasonable reader was just an average reader, not somebody in academia who is an economist. That's what the district court did, didn't it?
Right, and we believe that's not consistent with either Bryson or Tuitt. In both of those cases, the Illinois Supreme Court assumed a reasonable reader that had some level of sophistication regarding the subject matter. Remember, Bryson involved an article in 17 magazine, right, where a lady was referred to as a slut, I believe was the term used, and the question was, well, can somebody take an innocent construction of that? And even though you can look up senses in the dictionary that don't impute unchastity, the court was unwilling to do that and found that was not reasonable.
This is hardly comparable.
Well, certainly it takes account of the sophistication of the readers of 17 magazine, doesn't it, Your Honor? Similarly, in Tuitt, the publication in question was a corruption expose. And the defendant there, just like the defendants here, argued, well, we didn't call the plaintiff a crook, even though we called other people crooks in the book. And the Illinois Supreme Court was not impressed by that because it thought that assumes too much naivete on the part of the reader. So I believe that the district court's interpretation here was not consistent, even under Illinois state law. But that's not all there is. The problem in this case, and this now shades into the problem of federal procedure, is that the This complaint actually included allegations concerning who the reader was that the district court refused to accept, and indeed in making up this reasonable reader essentially went outside the complaint, which actions violate, I think, the accepted law, that the district court must accept the allegation of the complaint is true and draw all reasonable inferences in favor of the pleader.
Well, the judge did. Judge Castillo. He read the paragraph, and he, in fact, quoted the entire paragraph, and he said, these are the little section of this paragraph that you're claiming is defamatory, and he analyzed just that and said a person could come to a perfectly reasonable, non-defamatory view of what was said in that that sentence. And he does also, at least the book itself, pays some bit of a compliment to the plaintiff by saying that he has an admittedly intriguing hypothesis.
Well, Your Honor, I wasn't referring to that.
A compliment with one hand and slaps him with the other.
I wasn't referring to that part of the opinion. I was referring to the part that in the reported opinion is on page 580 of 469 F sub, where the district court makes note of Lott's allegation as to who the readership was and what the meaning, what meaning would be attached, and he says, I'm not going to follow that. I'm not bound by that. That's what I'm referring to when I say that the district court didn't apply the correct standards under Rule 12.
So if 100 people were to read this paragraph in this book, and one is an economist and would come to some different view than the other 99, it's defamation.
I wouldn't put it exactly that way, Your Honor. I would say what we're searching for here is what's the right standard under Rule 12b-6. And it seems to me that what we need to do is to formulate a standard under Rule 12b-6 that works for these kinds of cases, which tend to come up quite a bit. And it further seems to me that the right standard is a little bit subtle because of the problem of realizing that the innocent construction rule, in a way, is an exception to per se defamation. So what I would say is that the correct standard for the district court was to ask, could a reasonable jury find an innocent construction? And not try to resolve the question Your Honor poses, which to me sounds like a factual question, but rather ask the question whether on the circumstances and facts as pleaded, a reasonable jury could find a non-innocent construction. That's what it really comes down to. If a reasonable jury could find a non-innocent construction, then the Rule 12b-6 motion should not be granted. I'm going to reserve the balance of my time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Parker. Mr. Metcalf. May it please the Court, my name is Slade Metcalf. I'm here this morning on behalf of HarperCollins Publishers, as well as Stephen Levitt. Your Honors have focused already with Mr. Parker on some of the important issues here. Let me pick up, if I may, on the last issue that Mr. Parker mentioned. That is the issue of Rule 12b-6. It seems to me the question of what is the pleading standard here has already been answered in the Knafel case, just Judge Evans' decision in that case. I think the real issue here is the question of what is the innocent construction rule and whether the passage here that's complained about fits within that rule. And Judge Castillo, in short, got it right here. And appropriately, this really is a routine application of the innocent construction rule under Illinois substantive law. And here, and I think that Mr. Parker kind of flipped the test on its head when he finished his statement just now, in which it seemed to me that he said if anybody could find that there is a defamatory per se meaning within the passage, then therefore it should go on to the jury and they should make that determination. Well, in point of fact,
The Illinois Supreme Court has found that not to be the rule. Indeed, in the Tuitt case, which the Illinois Supreme Court decided about a year and a half ago, the argument by the plaintiff in that case is that the Illinois construction rule is out of date. It's too old. It's inconsistent with constitutional provisions as promulgated by the U.S. Supreme Court. And the Illinois Supreme Court found in that case that it was not inconsistent, and that indeed it is alive and vibrant and has meaning to it. And here, Judge Castillo indeed did apply it in the appropriate fashion. And as Your Honors have already pointed out, there is language in this passage which does elicit a reasonable, non-defamatory, per se meaning to this passage. And if I may take a couple of minutes here just to focus on the passage, that's why we're here this morning. The book itself is a book which is not an academic treatise. And Judge Castillo said in his opinion that he has read the book from cover to cover. The complaint in this case said that this was a book that had been read by millions of individuals in this country, that it was on the New York Times bestseller list for many weeks. In fact, it was on for over 2 years. And indeed, this is a book which was designed to relate to a non-academic person. But in any event, Judge Castillo appropriately took the approach that you need to define the reasonable meaning as it would apply and be understood by the reasonable reader. So what does the passage say? It says in leading up to, in this chapter 4, it said leading up to the passage, there was a discussion of various theories, ideas by various economists and other academicians who were hypothesizing why the crime rate in this country so dramatically decreased in the years after 1990, 91, 92. And many of those theories, such as more police officers on the street, more effective police policies, those in essence were debunked by Messrs. Levitt and Dubner in their book. And they ultimately came to the conclusion that indeed it was Roe v. Wade that was really the reason why there was such a dramatic decrease. And that was because of the availability of abortion in the early 70s that reduced the number of people who would be on the street to commit these crimes. But in doing so, in discussing the various issues and the various theories, the authors came upon Dr. Lott and Dr. Lott's theory, which had gained some amount of prominence in this country over a period of time. And what he says is that Dr. Lott is the main champion of an idea. And what was that idea? The idea was that if you put more guns in the hands of citizens, it's going to dramatically reduce the amount of crime in this country. And so what does Dr. Levitt say about that? He says his theory might be surprising, but it is sensible that you're going to scare some of the perpetrators who are going to break into somebody's home if they are afraid they're going to get shot by someone who has a gun in the house. So Dr. Lott goes on, and Dr. Levitt goes on, says, handgun opponents call Lott a pro-gun ideologue, and Lott let himself become a lightning rod for gun controversy. So we have these conflicting issues around the concept of gun control and the concept of what leads to reduce crime.
I thought that the point of the passage was about carrying weapons, not having a gun in the house.
Well,
the theory of Professor Lott was that these conceal and carry laws, so you're walking down the street, someone would be less apt to try to stick you up if they thought you were carrying a weapon of your own.
Judge Evans, you're correct on that, but I extended that into the concept of someone having the gun in the home. Certainly it applied, as Dr. Lott would also say, as handguns being carried around, concealed handguns, someone who's going to stick you up in the middle of the street may think twice if they think that you might be carrying a gun because you might shoot back before they accomplish their deed. In any event, the passage goes on and says, then there was the troubling allegation that Lott actually invented some of the survey data that supports his more guns, less crime theory. Now they say, well, we're not making a judgment. We're not making a judgment here whether that allegation is true or not true, because we say, regardless of whether the data were faked, Lott's admittedly intriguing hypothesis doesn't seem to be true. And now we finally get to the, after all the context, we finally get to the sentence that's at the issue in the complaint in this case, and it reads, when other scholars have tried to replicate his results, they found that right-to-carry laws simply don't bring down crime. Now, what Judge Castillo below said, one might conclude that there is a defamatory per se meaning from that sentence. But more importantly here, as the court well knows, that if there is any reasonable non-defamatory per se meaning to that sentence, then the case must be dismissed. No option. Must be dismissed. And Judge Castillo found in the context here that there was no discussion of protocols. There's no discussion of methodology. There's no discussion of the kinds of experiments or the kind of data that these people followed. Whether these other scholars even knew what Dr. Lott had at his disposal when he did his studies. So what they're saying, what Dr. Levitt and Steve Dubner are saying here is, when other scholars tried to replicate, come to the same conclusion as Dr. Lott had, that more guns in the hands of citizens reduces crime, they found that these right-to-carry laws simply didn't bring down crime. They disagreed with the conclusions, the theories, the results that Dr. Lott had come to. And on that basis, that is clearly a non-defamatory per se meaning to the passage, to that sentence, excuse me. And in so doing, once you're at that point, as they say, end of case, and Judge Castillo appropriately dismissed the first count of the complaint at that point. Now, I would also mention very briefly that we also argued in the court below on the first count that the passage is also protected because, as I've said, it's conflicting views, conflicting opinions. And in that case, under the various decisions in this court, including the Underwager case, the Haynes case, and the Dilworth case, all of those cases say that when you have disputes in the academic context, those are by their very nature, are opinions, and they're conflicting opinions. And when you have these conflicting opinions, the passage under the First Amendment is protected. Now, Judge Castillo didn't really need to get to that because he had already dismissed the first count on the grounds that there was one might say privileged under the innocent construction rule. But when he gets to the at the end of the case, I might note, in the conclusion to Judge Castillo's opinion below, he quotes from the Dilworth decision and says, the statements about Lott in Freakonomics reflected just such an academic controversy and nothing more. So there's an implication here, although not stated, there's an implication that Judge Castillo, had he been required to examine or analyze count one under the Dilworth concept of opinion, that he would have also likewise dismissed that first count. He didn't need to get to it. And in the second count, he found that the email that's no longer part of this case was not protected because, indeed, it was not in the context of that academic dispute. And there were certain statements in the email that the court decided were, in fact, statements of fact and therefore couldn't qualify as being protected opinion under the prevailing Supreme Court and Seventh Circuit law. So I would urge the court to also look at the question of opinion. We certainly think that there's more than a proper basis to have the a decision affirmed solely on the innocent construction rule, but also in context of the opinion argument as well. The only other views, I won't retrace what Mr. Parker said, but if there are any questions that the court has relating to the question of waiver, any of the other issues that may have been raised either in their briefs or on argument. I'd be delighted to answer them.
What about the futility argument on the amended complaint's allegation of defamation per quote?
Right. The amended complaint now divided the complaint into before it was two counts, but the second count had been settled and out of the case on the email. But the amended complaint now has two counts. One is the same libel per se count, which Judge Castillo had already dealt with and found that it was deficient, and there were no additional allegations in there that made it a viable claim. But the second claim is what they were moving to, which is the libel per quote claim, and there are no special damages at all, as certainly the Bryson case and many other Illinois state cases say, that the theory of libel per quote, there's a requirement, an element of the claim is that you must allege special damages, not just general or what the appellant calls actual damages. They're actual damages in a pecuniary form. So they have to be business losses, customers lost, articulated specific losses, special damages. They're nowhere in the amended complaint. So that second count for libel per quote is deficient on its face, and therefore, it's as Judge Castillo noted, it's futile for the plaintiff to move forward with this amended complaint because it's defective on its very nature. And under Seventh Circuit rulings, the court doesn't have to give someone an absolute right to file an amended complaint under Rule 15. The important thing is whether the proposed amended complaint does in fact state a claim, and Judge Castillo found it didn't, as he and rightly did, and if I can emphasize that is a his decision in that fashion is under an abuse of discretion theory, and under that theory, as the court knows, that if there's any reasonable person that agrees with a lower court's decision on that on abuse of discretion theory, therefore that decision should be upheld.
That count is not susceptible to the innocent construction rule, but it is non-actionable on an opinion analysis, even though that's not what Judge Castillo based his decision on.
Your Honor, we certainly would argue that. I think that just for purposes of our addressing the issue here is, again, it's abuse of discretion issue solely on the issue of lack of special damages, that second count is dismissible, as the court rightly held. No other questions? I'll sit down. Thank you,
Mr. Parker.
How much time?
Your Honors, let me thank Mr. Metcalf for asking me to clarify the point on what is the standard, because I think it's important to get it right. He referred, and he has referred in several cases, to the Dilworth case, and I think Your Honors ought to take a good close look at that case. I did page 29 of his brief, but not for the proposition he gives. This case actually arose under Wisconsin law, and in the opinion written by Judge Posner, it makes clearly the point we've been trying to stress, which we think also is in cases, prior cases of this court, including NAFL, and Muzikowski, and especially Action Repair. But what Judge Posner pointed out is the question of how this issue gets resolved in a federal court is a federal question. It's not a state question. So you don't just follow Illinois law. Now, extending that to the specific context here, we need to remember that libel per se versus libel per quote, these are really not two separate causes of action. In fact, as we show in the briefs, libel per quote was fairly alleged in the original complaint. The defendants thought so because they mentioned it in their moving papers, pages 63 and 66 of the appendix. They just didn't argue it in their brief, and so there was no answering argument at that point. But it was fairly within the context of the complaint, and under the decisions of this court, you look for alternative legal theories. Now, regarding how the innocent construction rule works, since it really is per se, as in Dilworth, when Judge Posner said, well, all you have to find is a jury could find that the statement is defamatory per se. All right? Now, Let's look at that in the context of this sort of backwards innocent construction rule, because the innocent construction rule is really an exception, right? So from that point of view, I think that the district court has to decide that a jury must find an innocent construction in order to take it out of the per se category, because the threshold of the per se category is whether a reasonable jury could find that the statement had a tendency to be per se defamatory. And I hope I finally got that clear. And in regard to the...
Except that's not how the rule operates in Illinois.
That is not how the... Yes, Your Honor is quite correct.
You're arguing that's how we should apply it, but that's not how the Illinois courts apply it.
Your Honor is quite correct. And Mr. Metcalf referred to the dissenting opinion in Tuitt, which is exactly the point that the judge makes there, which is if you have a real jury trial right, this rule doesn't make any sense.
Right, but we don't follow dissents. We follow the majority opinion. And the majority opinion has the rule, as stated by Judge Castillo, that if it's susceptible, if the statement at issue is susceptible of an innocent construction, then that's the end of the case.
Right. And our argument is that rule does not apply in the federal courts.
Of course it does. It's a substantive rule
Bird
in Illinois
versus,
law.
Bird
we
versus,
are required to apply the Illinois version of the law.
Not insofar as it affects the allocation of function between judge and jury. This court has held that several times. In Dilworth, Muzikowski, Action Repair. It's recognized that point and held otherwise. I respectfully submit to Your Honor. It doesn't matter how the state law construes. Under the Supreme Court's authority, Byrd versus Blue Ridge, it's always a federal question, the allocation of judge versus jury decision-making in a federal court. You never follow the state law. Another pertinent authority that we cite is Gasparini. Same holding. It's just not correct to say you follow the state law. And, in fact, that's not what this court has done. Now, let me also address some of the other points regarding the pleading of per quote defamation. That, again, is another area where I think the court has to take account of the Erie Doctrine. What is cited in the district court and what is cited by the defense are Illinois state cases, again, state pleading cases. They don't apply in the United States courts. Pleading in the United States courts is governed by the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, period. No exceptions, no variations depending on what state you're in. It's uniform law, Hanna versus Plumer. So here again, and under this court's decisions under Rule 9G, which is the applicable rule, the holdings are there is no particularity required. There's only specificity, which is not the same thing. Now, finally, I wanted to address this sort of general theme that I think that the opposing counsel has tried to establish, which is, well, this is really just an academic debate, and this is in regard to the question Judge Sykes raised concerning the applicability of the First Amendment. In reality, what's being challenged here is not who's right in terms of whether concealed carry laws bring down crime or push up crime or leave crime alone. That's not the thrust of the allegation here. The thrust of the allegation was the false statements as to what other scholars did. The allegation was that other scholars tried to replicate and couldn't. Whereas in the district court, since that's not unquestionably not true, since they did try to replicate, since they didn't try to replicate, and where they did, they could do so, the district court reread the passage to say that, well, that doesn't really mean they tried to replicate. It really means they tried to come to a different conclusion. That's what the court says. And so it's not about the academic debate at all. That's not even a fair argument, in my opinion. And finally, let me mention the motion for leave to amend. I think it's a misstatement to say that the district court has discretion in this context. Remember that this was a first amended complaint, that the futility ground presents a question of law to this court. You have to agree with the district court. It's only discretionary if the motion for leave to amend comes after judgment. And I think one of the problems in this case, and I believe, although I don't know for sure, is that Judge Castillo may have been laboring under the misimpression that he had previously entered a judgment in this case, which he had not even a partial judgment. And so it was, he had no discretion. Thank the court.
Thank you. This case will be taken under advisement, and we'll proceed to